Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Culture Vulture.
Kia ora, everybody, and welcome to part two of our special Taylor Swift editions of Culture Vulture. Liv, how are you feeling after last edition?
I feel like I learned a lot. I feel like I was thrown into multiple relationships.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel good.
Yeah, so yeah. Do I. I feel like I'm ready to learn about why the fuck she's re-releasing all of these albums, because for anyone that doesn't know, because why would you? Liv has done the research on all of this, like, legal stuff and why she had to re-release the albums. And for the second half of this episode, I'm just going to sit here and just soak it all up. But for the first half, I'm going to talk to you about the final few eras before all of the re-records started happening. Now, in 2019, we had her Lover era. Now, this was like...
Lover. I just love it how she says that.
I know. This was like a 180 from her Reputation era. It was like, Reputation was like, I don't know, grungy, black, dark. And then this era is like literally butterflies, rainbows, pink, bright colours.
Did she open with me? Like, was that the first single?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I did not like.
No.
Oh, my God. Lover, I mean, wasn't my favourite album whatsoever. It was unique. Me did not... do it for me. But there was like just a notable shift of her really being in love. And like, I don't know, I just feel like she just wanted to scream it from the rooftops and kind of happy for her. She also signaled that maybe the old Taylor wasn't dead after all. You know how she was like, the old Taylor's dead, but it's like, no, you're just wanting to sort of remove yourself from that like public persona that everyone decided to hate, because fair enough.
It's like Miley Cyrus breaking away from Disney, Demi Lovato. Like, you know, they've all done it. They have this squeaky clean persona, and that is, it's a big
phase.
Pressure.
Yeah.
To handle. So yeah, you've got to go through.
You have to
go too far
it.
And then bring yourself back.
Exactly. So she said when she was writing about this album, she said, I've decided that in this life I want to be defined by the things I love, not the things I hate, the things I'm afraid of, or the things that haunt me in the middle of the night. Those things may be my struggles, but they're not my identity, which really, like, rounds out her coming back from Reputation, being like, that was a phase, that was fine, like, it did what it needed to do, but now I'm just going to, like, be my authentic self. Her look with this came with, obviously, a lot of brighter and more colourful colours, for lack of a better word. Word? I do have a lack of a better word.
Because Worth is going down the toilet right now.
Oh my God,
your identity is a fantastic podcast.
Forgot how to talk. Yeah. There was a lot of pink, a lot of purple. There was a lot of like 70s inspired clothes. Like, that's, we all know what the Lover era looked like. And I can't even, and I'm not even going to talk about the relationships that defined this era, because it was one relationship. It was Joe Alwyn, her boyfriend, possibly engaged person. What do you call that?
Fiance.
We don't know if that's confirmed, and she doesn't owe us that at all, but Joe Alwyn, who actually was rumoured to have ghostwritten a few of these songs under a pseudonym.
Yes.
Rumoured. We don't know, but probably.
Well, we know about Exile.
So, do we?
Yeah, but that's not Lover, but we're jumping ahead now. But we do know Exile. She's said it on a lot of interviews, yeah.
Okay, love that for them. Well, now that we've talked enough about Lover, because it wasn't my favourite, so why would we talk more about it?
Because
it's all about me, obviously. No, we get to the folky era, which really, to me, feels the most, like, rounded out. It's like she's been through all the genres, she's been through all the identities she needs to, and then she's found herself, her sound, her style.
She really has, like, it's beautiful storytelling from the country era, and then we've got, like, some lovely production from her reputation. Yeah, Jack Antonoff, shout out. And then, yeah, we've got this sort of subdued but very elegant and eloquent body of work.
It's just stunning. I think, I honestly think this is my favourite of Taylor's eras. And I was saying to Liv the other day that I wouldn't mind if this was her final era. Like, I feel like she's rounded out. She's given us enough. She doesn't owe us enough. Obviously, the songwriting and singing is her bread and butter. So if she wants to release more music, there's a high chance she will and she can. But if this was her last era,
like, wouldn't be mad about it.
Wouldn't be mad about it. So in this era, she had Folklore and she had Evermore, and she was really embracing, like, the cottagecore aesthetic. Yeah. So, like, and these were both surprise releases. So in July 2020, that was when Folklore came out. And then in December of 2020, that was when the sister album Evermore came out. And they were written during quarantine. And she just, honestly, she just worked so fucking hard.
I think it, like, foreshadows her savviness as a business person and also, like, her trust in her fan base to be able to, you know, drop these albums without any marketing. Only, like, her and Beyonce and, you know, like, limited artists can do that. Because those people with such a core, you know, fandom.
Yes, yeah, can do that, and they know that people will love it.
Exactly, and that foreshadows the re-record, because that's what that was all about. But anyway,
carry on. So the last thing that rounds out this era was obviously her, like, she was back wearing her braids, her natural hair, her flannel shirts, the famous cardigan that the song Cardigan was, like, written about. And, yeah, I think this was my favourite era. But now, Liv, now that we've been through every single one of her eras, we're sort of into dipping back into some old eras, like Fearless, because she's re-released that, and now Red, because she's re-released that. So I would like to call on Culture Vulture's resident music industry lawyer, Olivia, to discuss why the hell Taylor Swift doesn't have to but wants to re-record these old albums.
Now, thank you, Lucy. That is quite the title, which I am not going to live up to.
We're not experts around here. She should care about that.
To being a lawyer. But anyway, I will tell you what I know and what I have researched. And it is fucking interesting.
I'm so excited.
So basically, before we get into the sort of, like, nuts and bolts of why she re-recorded her albums, we first need to understand the basis of the whole thing, which is the whole deal of music ownership.
Teach me.
So there are two types of ownership when it comes to music recording. There's the master ownership, and then there's the musical work ownership. So the master ownership is the ownership of the specific sound recording, like, it's what you're hearing on your Spotify account or on your Apple Music. Like
that, the final product.
Yeah, that final product, that final recording is the master ownership. Whereas the musical work means that the person or the company owns the publishing rights, which covers everything in the musical work that existed before it became a recording. So things like sheet music, melodies, lyrics, instrumental arrangements.
Love that.
All of that.
Right.
So those are our two categories, and they're very important to understand what unfolds.
Okay, so just so that we're all clear, master ownership is the final product, all done, like
the digital recording.
Digital recording. That's what we hear on Fearless, not Taylor's version. And then the musical work ownership is basically everything else that led up to that, bar, like, you know, the final recording. So, like, voice memos and her having written this down on her own, like, pen and paper and stuff. Two very different things. Right.
Absolutely. So this is relevant because when Taylor signed to a record label called Big Machine Records when she was 15, she signed a contract saying that the record label owned the rights to the masters, whereas Taylor herself, as the main songwriter, owned the publishing rights to the music, which is the musical work rights.
Okay.
So this is a pretty standard contract. Most musicians, mm-hmm. like most of your favorite musicians, the really successful ones, don't even own the rights to their own masters. They often sign these away in order to get an advance from the record label, which can seem really good at the time because, you know, you've got this huge sum of money. You're like, fuck yeah, this is great. But it's not in their best interest for the long run.
Mm.
So basically, as Lucy said last episode, Taylor was sort of scouted, I would say, at a Nashville industry showcase in 2005. And she caught the attention of a man called Scott Bruschetta. Okay, I always want to call him Scott Bruschetta.
Yeah.
And I just need to refrain. So Scott Bruschetta was, at the time, a DreamWorks Records executive, and he was about to launch his own label called Big Machine Records. So she then signed a 13-year contract with this new record label, Big Machine Records, and made 6 studio albums with them. So these are the ones we've already talked about, her self-titled album Taylor Swift, Fearless, Red, 1989, and Reputation.
And Speak Now.
And Taylor was actually... she was either the first artist or one of the very first artists to be signed to the record. And her dad, like, you know, backed it 100%. He saw this as a really good investment and he bought 3% of the shares of the company.
So she was one of the first artists to be signed to Big Machine Records when Scott Bullshooter was like, I'm going to leave DreamWorks. I'm going to start my own thing. And was her dad sort of like, okay, I see the value in Taylor Swift. Let me invest in this company. Let me buy some shares.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So her and her family had a huge hand in sort of the, you know, come up of this company.
Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't just, you know, signed to Universal or Sony, you know, like those huge companies that already have a lot going for them. Like she was sort of
the value, right?
Which is quite important.
It's quite interesting.
Mm. Yeah. So once she had fulfilled that 13-year contract where she made those 6 albums, she decided that she wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was because she was older, she was savvier about the music industry and her rights as a musician, and she basically wanted more control over her music. So the thing is, when she left Big Machine Records, they still did and always will have the rights to her masters.
For those six albums.
Yeah, for those 6 albums. So everything she recorded under them, they have the rights to the masters, which is what you hear on Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
And Taylor said in a blog post to her fans that she had made peace with the fact that Scott Bruschetta would sell her masters at some point. But when that did eventually happen, Taylor was horrified, not because he sold them, but because of who he sold them to. So Bruschetta sold Big Machine Records to private equity groups Ithaca Holdings, which was a company owned by a man by the name Scott Samuel Braun, or better known as Scooter Braun. Mm. And this is when shit really hit the fan.
And Taylor did want the chance to buy back her masters, didn't she?
She absolutely did. And I mean, we'll get into this.
Can't
but you
wait.
Know, this was always on the cards. She's very fucking savvy businesswoman. She knows what she's doing. She knew, you know,
that the music industry was fucking her over.
Absolutely.
Rather, these couple of people.
So if you've heard the name Scooter Braun, to be honest, it's probably because of this Taylor Swift drama.
Or no, Justin Bieber.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, but you may have also heard him because he's a pretty famous music manager. He's a big man in the industry. He has managed stars such as Justin Bieber, Ariana Grande, and Demi Lovato. He's actually been in a few of these stars' documentaries. If you've ever seen Demi's latest one, he features in Ariana's. So yeah, he's a big fish.
Mm.
So basically, Taylor had a relationship with Scooter Braun. As we have said before, she had major beef with Ye. And the person managing Ye at the time that all of this beef unfolded was Scooter Braun. So he was, you know, behind the scenes during the VMA debacle. She blames him for orchestrating a lot of what happened during the Famous era.
Oh my gosh, I did not know that Scooter was on Ye's team during this.
Yeah, so he was sort of like in and out of Ye's management, but he was definitely managing him during these times.
These levels. Yeah.
And so there were also some sort of murky online behavior between him and his artists. I don't know.
Justin Bieber sort of standing up for Scooter even when he shouldn't have
that
been.
That kind of like low key.
Like not explicitly, but Taylor knew it was directed at her.
Yeah, exactly.
It can just be the worst because you almost feel gaslit.
Absolutely. So there was a whole lot of shit going on. So I think we can understand why Taylor was so devastated when she discovered that her catalogue was going to a man who promoted all of this material.
And you who hadn't respected her.
No, exactly. So, he sees money and he's going to do what makes money. And
what's
so,
going to make money? Taylor Swift's masters.
Yeah, exactly. So he was pretty much the worst person to sell Taylor's music to. She said in a blog post to fans, like when Kim Kardashian orchestrated an illegally recorded snippet of a phone call to be leaked and then Scooter got his two clients together to bully me online about it, she wrote, or when his client Kanye West organized a revenge porn music video which strips my body naked, or now Scooter has stripped me of my life's work and I wasn't even given an opportunity to buy. Essentially, my music legacy is about to lie in the hands of someone who tried to dismantle it. So
just like she was like. And like for a second, imagine you'd written six albums that was your heart and soul.
Well, this
quite
is
literally.
The thing. Like, you know, so personal.
So personal.
As we've literally just had a whole episode on all of her romantic relationships. Like she writes deeply, deeply personal songs. So
and someone
her,
else is profiting off of it and someone that's actually bullied you and that stood up for the person that has made you feel as shit as you could possibly feel in the world.
Exactly. So basically when it was sold to Scooter Braun, it was sold for a lot. We're talking like north of $300 million.
Mm. And that actually kind of feels low to me, but when you think about the money that it will make from people playing it.
Yeah. Good absolutely. Purchase. So this is how much, well, it was rumored somewhere around $300 million and $450 million for Big Machine Records. And because Taylor was one of the first artists, she actually holds like majority of the value, like her songs, a majority of the value of
that
whole
company.
So, you know, I at first thought, oh, you know, surely there's lots of other artists that it's like, is it really all about you? But it actually is in this scenario. Like this was a small company, as we had said, and her dad was invested in it. Mm. Like, you know, this is a deeply personal company.
And it's so interesting, just like on a slight tangent, that obviously her dad was a minority shareholder. So like he must not have gotten a say in the selling of his own daughter's masters.
Yeah, I read that he was actually not allowed to come to certain meetings because, you know, what's that
conflict
thing?
Conflict of interest.
He was a conflict of interest. So yeah, there's a whole lot of shit there. And then basically, Scooter Braun later went on to sell her whole catalogue to another company called Shamrock Holdings for $300 million. And I'm guessing this was when, like, the re-recording was announced, so he knew that, you know, this
it
was the right
money.
Time. But also, he's still profiting from them via the contract that he holds with Shamrock Recordings. So there's just a whole lot of shit there, right? Like, this
he would have written into that contract, like, yeah, I'm going to sell them to you because I know they're going to lose money, but let me just put a wee clause in here that makes sure that I'll still get some money from the plays that they get for now.
Exactly, like, this guy is obviously, like, good at his job.
Good at his job.
Good at his job at making money. And
he's the man that Taylor Swift writes about. Yeah. He can be complex. He can be cool.
He is. So all throughout her contract at Big Machine Records, as we've prefaced, Taylor had been trying to buy the rights to all of her masters, but Scott Borchetta, so the guy who used to be the CEO of
Big Machine,
pretty much made it impossible to do so. And then when she kept trying to buy it, I think that there was something about, he was like, you can have the masters if you continue your contract. Like, you know, there was a lot of like back and forth wheeling and dealing going on. Like nothing was transparent. There was no, like, he didn't even put a price on them basically. Mm. And then when it was transferred to Scooter, she was still trying to buy these masters and she said that they wanted me to sign an ironclad NDA stating I would never say another word about Scooter Braun unless it was positive before we could even look at the financial records of big machine.
Oh.
Yeah, which was always the first step in the purchase of this, in a purchase of this nature. I would have to sign a document that would silence me before I could even have the chance to bid on my own work.
I'm sorry, but that's a double standard because I doubt Scooter Braun had to sign an NDA to not say anything about Taylor, or even if he did, he got his little other minions to go online and say other things about her.
Taylor obviously made this very public, but it was because
she was being wronged so heavily.
Yeah, and she wants other people to know what the fuck is actually going on in the music industry.
Yes.
I feel like there's a lot of hush-hush from what it sounds like. And they really played on this, you know, saying that she's making it public, wanting attention, blah, 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 blah.
Like, no, you're doing shit things to a person. They should be able to talk about it. She should write a song about it.
Yeah, exactly. And then Taylor reached out to her fans again via another blog post explaining what had happened, and then said that the only way around this situation was to re-record the entirety of those six albums, because as we said before, she still had those, like, you know, music works rights.
Yes.
She has
the complete right to re-record them.
To her sheet music. She had all of that. She just had to wait until, I think it was November 2020,
right,
when her contract had ended for 2 years to put this in place.
Okay.
She was also told that she wasn't allowed to sing her songs at the 2019 AMAs when she was awarded Artist of the Decade, as this would be seen as re-recording her material before she contractually had the right to do so.
So what did she do? Did she just not perform?
Yeah, so she had to use other songs. I think Lover might have come out by then.
Yes, okay, yep.
But she couldn't use any of her back catalogue.
Oh my God.
And then also, if you have seen her documentary Miss Americana, you might have realised that none of that contained any of her back catalogue either. And this was for the same reason.
Fucking hell.
So there was a whole lot of shit going on. Scooter Braun actually did start receiving death threats, which is when stanning absolutely goes too far. He also urged Taylor to have a conversation about it. He didn't really say much publicly about the allegations, except that he wanted to talk to Taylor privately about everything that was going on, because obviously he didn't want his name to be tarnished.
It's so interesting because Taylor's the only one that's ever been sort of,
brave
not the only
enough.
One ever, but she's been transparent, she's been brave about it. She's not the first person to re-record her masters. JoJo also did a similar thing, but she is the first person to be very, very vocal to her fans and to younger artists about why it's important to do this.
Absolutely.
And, like, good
on her. So people know their rights. And as I said before, you know, they kept using social media, like, oh, she's using social media. It was back in that time when social media wasn't, you know, to shine light on shit going on in the world. It was like a personal thing where if you put it on social media, it felt like you were just crying out for attention.
Oh my God,
and so
yeah,
they just really, really played on that narrative. And then he did quote, "To be frank, I was shocked and disheartened to hear that my presence in the Big Machine deal caused you so much pain, as the handful of times we have actually met, I have always remembered them to be pleasant and respectful. Knowing what I know now, all I have wanted to do is rectify this situation." So,
of course, every time they met, though, it was pleasant and respectful, because Taylor wanted to, one, buy the records, and two, she was just expected to always play the good girl. It's not like she was going to snub him or, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
He owns all the music.
There was a whole lot of stuff, and there was also a whole lot more sort of back and forth about the AMAs, but, you know, it's just all a bit murky. So
it's just that she didn't and wasn't allowed to own her masters, and so you've been saying she's extremely savvy. What does she do? She just re-records them and better.
Absolutely. So she's re-recorded, well, she started re-recording these albums. We've got Fearless, and now we have Red as of a couple of days ago. Both amazing. Mm-hmm. She's marketed the re-recorded albums as Taylor's version, like, as opposed to Scooter's version. So if you listen to Taylor's version, the money is going to Taylor, not Scooter or whoever owns Shamrock Holdings or whatever's going on there. So, yeah, not only is Taylor an extremely savvy businesswoman, but she is honestly making history for the music industry in regards to musicians' rights and their own music. Like,
even the fact that we know about the difference between, like, her owning her, like, publishing rights and, like, the master rights.
Yes, absolutely.
And now if, like, we were to go sign a contract, we'd be like, no, we need all of them.
Well,
or you're not getting
them. Absolutely. And so, like, now there's a whole lot of labels, newer labels, that are being like, we don't hold your master's rights. Like, you know, it's becoming something that people look for in contracts. Like, you know, It's
your next era.
You don't
lawyer.
Know it if you don't know it. So yeah. She's really bringing light to a situation where people, you know, it was always, but that's just the way it is. And it's like, yeah, but why is that the way it is when you're screwing over the artist whose music it actually is and you're just like profiting off of it? So also she's in a really rare position of having this huge dedicated fan base, that this wasn't such a huge risk for her as it would have been for other artists. So I'm guessing that this is why a lot of other artists haven't bothered to re-record their albums, because they don't know that they have that backing to make it all worthwhile. You know, this would have cost a huge amount of money. This would have been a huge gamble for anyone who didn't know that they had millions of people backing their every move. So it's really amazing because it shows that the consumer has power.
Yes.
You know, we have power in what we listen to. If we boycott, you know, the old versions of the music, we're actually doing something for the music industry and paving how we want it to be. And also, as artists get bigger, their piece of the pie gets smaller, as we see with a lot of companies, right? So it's like, this is so important, because if that piece of the pie is already small, you know, if it's just getting smaller and smaller, they just don't have any control anymore. And this is what she's fighting for. So yeah, basically just like a huge fucking commentary on this hungry machine that the music industry has turned into.
I'm extremely proud of her, and I'm extremely like proud of everyone for taking the time to also like learn why she's done this. Like, yes, she's had to teach us, but everyone's chosen where to learn and chosen to learn about it, and like you said, where to put not so much our money but like our ears and where to consume it. And you know, maybe it's easier to not change her old songs out of your playlist, but now that you've heard this and you're like, oh well, I don't want the money to be going to these people that, you know, like are fucking the music industry, let me take the time to swap out and put Taylor's version on my playlist. And it's like, we can all do a little bit, and she's got us there, and just like fucking big ups to her.
Yeah, fuck yeah, because she's like always been written off as someone that like, oh, she just causes so much hassle. Like, you know, just why are you...
Why is she writing about that? Why has she got her girl squad like that? Why is she such a snake? Why is she re-recording her masters? It's like, well, this is why.
But it's actually bravery, isn't
it? It's extreme bravery.
It's like she knows that people are going to have this view on her, but she does it anyway because she knows that in the long run,
it's better for everyone.
It's the fucking right thing to do. Yeah.
We love you, Taylor Swift. If you're listening to this.
I've got myself so passionate about
it. About Taylor Swift single-handedly saving the music industry.
The music industry.
Oh, well, Liv, thank you very much for coming on this journey of Taylor Swift through the eras, snaking through the forest, coming out in the folky woods.
We are out of the woods.
Yeah. And that snowmobile accident that allegedly killed someone.
Let us know.
Do you have any more tips on that? Have you listened to the last episode? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Good song, though. No Money, No Crime.
Oh, great song. Yeah. We do have to give a massive, massive thank you to Tiahe Butler, our producer and wonderful human who has stayed in this sweaty little room with us to make these special episodes happen for you.
It is honestly a sauna. Like, I haven't sweated this much in a very long time.
Just a little bit of oversharing, as Taylor Swift would, as she wants, besties.
We're going to get personal.
It's very hot in here. Anyway, we will see you for your usual scheduled Culture Vulture episode on Wednesday. And it's just been a ride. It's been great.
I loved it.
Thank you all for listening. Share it however you want. Come find us wherever you want. See you next week.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas.
We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.